Hello and welcome to this BJS podcast. I'm Wendy Barnaby. Today we'll be hearing about venous thromboembolism and how vascular units would need to work differently to follow recent treatment guidelines from NICE, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence. We'll be hearing from Jerry Stansby and Bruce Braithwaite. Jerry is Professor of Vascular Surgery at the Freeman Hospital in Newcastle-upon-Tyne. And Jerry, let's begin with you. You've co-authored a leader in the July BJS summarising the recommendations of the NICE guideline. Can you tell me, what was your role in developing the guideline?
Well, I chaired the guideline group for NICE, and NICE are instructed to do guidelines on behalf of the NHS, the Department of Health at that stage it was. And we put together a group of representatives of various specialties and also lay members in order to look at the problem of venous thromboembolism as to how it could be best diagnosed and managed and treated within the NHS. And that was on the back of a previous guideline that I'd been involved with a couple of years earlier, where we'd looked at prevention of DVT and pulmonary embolus.
Right. Well, we'll come on to the DVT aspects of it in a minute. But just before we do that, could you tell us briefly about the other things that it deals with? Because it does talk about using filters, doesn't it, and investigations for cancer?
Yeah, those are things which are not in too many other guidelines. So we've gone a little bit further than previous advice with those. We've laid out some very sort of easy to follow algorithms for how you go through the diagnostic pathways for DVT and PE. And in certain subgroups of patients where it's very difficult to manage them with anticoagulants, we are endorsing the use of filters in the vena cava. And in patients who have a spontaneous VTE, i.e. a DVT or a pulmonary embolus that occurs without any obvious cause, we're actually recommending that you should consider investigating them specifically to see if they have an underlying cancer. And that's a relatively new but important recommendation, not in most other guidelines.
And as far as the filters are concerned, I think you recommend looking at taking them out as well as putting them in.
Yeah, I mean, filters are a very interesting topic because they've actually been available for use for nearly 50 years. Unfortunately, there have been very few randomised trials on their use during that time. And a lot of them are put in for reasons that are not entirely clear, and then they're not taken out afterwards. And we nowadays have filters which can do a really good job on a temporary basis, and then 2 to 6 weeks later can be removed after that job's been done. If they're left in, there is a risk that the person will get further thrombosis on top of the filter in the future and may end up with things like swollen legs and edema of the legs or post-thrombotic syndrome being made worse. So it is really important that people have a protocol to follow when they put in filters that involves the correct indications, but also prompts them to make sure they remove them when they're not needed anymore.
The new guidance about treating acute iliofemoral DVT is all about getting to grips with clots early so that patients have less chance of developing post-thrombotic syndrome, isn't it? So what does the guidance say?
Well, the guidance says that if you have an iliofemoral DVT in a patient who has a reasonable life expectancy and significant symptoms, and no contraindications to thrombolysis, because thrombolysis, of course, can increase the risk of bleeding, then you should consider thrombolysis. And the rationale behind that is that if you don't do that, the person is more likely to end up with a painful, swollen leg long-term due to post-thrombotic syndrome. And some of those patients may even progress on to leg ulceration. And unfortunately, you have to get successful thrombolysis, you probably have to act reasonably quickly. And that's one of the problems, I think, because most of the relevant cases are coming in under the non-surgical teams, and there aren't established good multidisciplinary approaches to getting patients transferred over for a vascular opinion and consideration of thrombolysis.
Well, thanks, Joe, for the moment. Let's turn to Mr. Bruce Braithwaite, who's consultant vascular surgeon at University Hospital Nottingham. You've co-authored a paper, Bruce, on venous thrombolysis in the July issue of the BJS. Let's stick with DVT. Your paper looks back to see how patients at your own hospital were treated for DVT over an 18-month period up to February 2012. During that period, what sort of treatment did they get?
Well, in that treatment, you know, in that time period, they were treated, some of them, with thrombolysis, but it was very much an evolving practice. I mean, it's probably important to go back to how things were, because a lot of people listening will probably have that kind of system in their hospital. Nearly all DVTs are currently managed by a nurse-led service, often based in the community or being paid for by the community team. I mean, sometimes it's actually in the hospital. So in Queens, we have nurses, but they're employed essentially by the primary care team to assess patients who may or may not have a deep vein thrombosis. If they suspect they have them, and there's various tests that can be done, then they're given a blood thinning agent by an injection, something called heparin, and then brought back several days later for an ultrasound scan when the next slot is available to confirm whether they do or do not have a DVT. And then if they do have a DVT, they're given anticoagulation with a drug called warfarin, which is usually then managed by the haematologists. So up to us really getting involved, the only people involved in these patients' care were the nurses, the haematologists, and the respiratory physicians, and the latter only got involved if a patient then got a pulmonary embolus. So that was pretty much the state of play. We would occasionally get patients who had a very large iliofemoral DVT, we'd be asked to see them and would then, having discussed things, arrange for them to have some thrombolysis. But the thrombolysis and using a way of mincing up the vein, something called an angiojet, that's only because we've had some very enthusiastic interventional radiologists that we work with in the team. And we're very much blessed that we now have six interventional radiologists, so we can now offer a 24/7 service, which means we realised we were in a position to help patients who had iliofemoral DVTs much more on a 24/7 service, which is what the NICE recommendations come out with. So what happened in the 18 months is we started to develop a relationship with the nurses. Essentially, we went down to the nurses in A&E and said, if someone comes in with a DVT and it's a big one and you're worried, what do you do? And they usually say, oh, well, we'll just ask the medical registrar, and then the patients would go through what I've just described. But now what we've achieved is that the nurses will actually call one of our team and we'll assess the patient, and then we'll take them on for thrombolysis if required. Now, during that 18-month period, it became obvious we were only seeing a few patients who had developed iliofemoral DVT, and the research that John Saunders pretty much instigated was to go and look at how many patients over that 18-month period we could have treated if we'd applied the NICE guidance, and we realised that actually there were a lot of people we didn't even know about. So there were a lot of people who were being kind of dealt with by the normal anticoagulation but might well have benefited from having some intervention.
Yes, I think according to your figures, you discovered about 40% of patients would have been suitable for thrombolysis.
Exactly. And as Jerry's pointed out, there are some patients we may not be able to treat, but the younger patients, the ones that don't have end-stage cancer, the ones that are going to be able to survive, we just weren't seeing them.
And so it sounds like a pretty upbeat story. I mean, some things have changed in your hospital as a result of your findings. Are you doing things very differently now with the relationship with the nurses and so on?
Well, it's not as good as I'm sure it could get, because you'll have to appreciate we're talking with four different disciplines. There's the nurses, maybe more actually, the nurses, the haematologists, the respiratory team, consultant vascular surgeons and interventional radiologists. And nothing happens overnight in any organisation, let alone the NHS. But the nurses know that if they have a patient they suspect has got an iliofemoral DVT, they can now pick up the phone and a vascular registrar will see the patient. We will rescan the patient in our own vascular lab to make sure it is an iliofemoral DVT. And if it is, they will then go on for further imaging or may go straight off to radiology to be treated. So what is now happening is our time from referral to actually starting thrombolysis on the last three patients, which have happened over the last couple of months, has been about 4 hours. So Jerry talked about we need to get onto these things quickly, but when we select the patients, they are getting very, very quick treatment on the same day as we're making the diagnosis. And what we think is very important is to get the message out to all clinicians of all types that there might be a way of treating these patients with iliofemoral DVT that they don't know about, and they should start calling their vascular surgeons.
Yes, do you think that there should be a specialist vascular ward, perhaps?
Well, most hospitals will have a specialist vascular ward, but you do raise the question about actually the, which we've written about in the paper, which is the problem of resource. You know, what's happened is there's now a centralisation of vascular services across the UK because it benefits patients, but there will still be patients presenting with DVT in lots of hospitals that don't have an on-site vascular service. So if NICE guidance is completely applied by hospitals, I can see patients with iliofemoral DVTs being moved from one hospital to the major regional unit, because it's only the major regional unit which will have the radiologists and the consultant vascular surgeons that can deal with the problem on the same day. So in terms of saying we need a specialist ward, well, we have them, but I think we need a specialist pathway where all of these patients will get moved into the central vascular units around the UK.
Well, thank you very much, Bruce. And let's come back to Jerry. And really, it's the same $64,000 question to you. What's happening at your own hospital? Has the management of DVT changed there as a result of your guideline?
Yeah, I think it has changed. We have a hospital thrombosis committee, which existed before the guidelines, but is becoming stronger and more established now. And we're represented on that, as well as the other specialties. So we do have a way of communicating. And we have very good support now from both our radiologists, as Bruce described, but also from our haematology colleagues and the specialist DVT nurses. So we're moving towards a much better multidisciplinary team approach to managing this really very common condition, and a condition I would add that causes a lot of unnecessary deaths still in the UK. So I think we're moving forward nicely at the moment. We've got to keep the momentum up.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Jerry, and to you too, Bruce. And that's all we have time for. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.